Well, this evening we're going to have a little adventure in symbolism. In an effort to try to clarify a term that many books could be written about, we've met in the first of this series of discussions that alchemy was, at least to a degree, a breaking forth of the spirit of mysticism which had been locked in the hearts and minds of pre-Renaissance men. The breakdown of the tremendous domination of the aristocracy and the clergy resulted in the beginning of a motion towards intellectual liberty. And in the transition period, we had about two centuries in which mystical movements developed and expanded in an astonishing manner. We know that these movements came directly from a movement within man himself. And in this, we come to a very important and interesting problem. How does the human being think? Does he think in words, in pictures, or in pure ideas? I think we learn from the study of persons changing languages that a great many human beings think in words. And we know, for example, that in the study of language, you must labor along a difficult and unfamiliar path until you begin to think in the language which you are studying. And then suddenly the words become meaningful and available. I know persons who have lived in this country for many years and speak the English language well, but in a hurry they will count in their native language. Therefore, there is a certain association between thought and words. It is probable that the intellectualist thinks in the terms of words, because he uses them constantly. They are the familiar instrument of self-expression. It is also quite possible that the artist, the purely aesthetic individual, may think in form, or in color, or even in tone, as in the case of the musician. Thus, the origin of thought patterns may differ with different persons. And the basic chemistry of thought patterns probably differs also in the male and female. Thus, we are confronted with an intricate issue of the basic form of ideas within ourselves. Studies in anthropology and ethnology lead us to the recognition of the universality of certain essential emblems and figures. I had a letter yesterday which, strange enough to report, I answered today. Not very often happens. Relating to a tomb recently discovered at Palenque in Mexico, in Chiapas. Palenque is one of the old centers of the Maya culture. This tomb was the physical remain, mostly dust, of some ancient dignitary of the empire. And in the disintegrating and ruinous state of the mortal remains of this person, it was noted that in one hand of the deceased had been placed a small sphere of jadeite, and in the other hand, a small cube of jadeite. There are also many other ornaments of precious and semi-precious materials. The letter asked why those two jadeite ornaments should have been associated with the dead. Well, there are several possibilities. The cube of the sphere was early associated with architecture, and similar remains were found within certain of the pyramids in Egypt. They were used for the simple process of laying a foundation. When the builder was not sure whether his levels were clear and right. He would stand a cube on a flat place on his wall, place the sphere on top of it. If it rolled off, then he had not a level foundation. Now this peculiar relationship caused these little instruments to be associated with the craft of building. We have an evidence of them today in the Masonic Council Square. The compass makes a circle, and the square measures a cube. So we're back again to the concept of the sphere and the cube. One representing the sphere, life, spirit, consciousness. The cube, matter, body, earth. But that these should be placed in the hands of this deceased aristocrat of the old Maya Empire may have been one of several things. Perhaps he was a priestly architect, bearing the insignia of his profession, because architecture was an important craft in art among these people. Perhaps he was a priest philosopher architect, one who had received the proper recognition as a master builder of men, or a custodian of truths. Perhaps it was an ancient symbol that the body returns to the earth from which it came, the cube, and the spirit returns to Dal Gaeta, the sphere. Certainly, however, these symbols were there. They are in China. They are in India. They are in Egypt. They are in Greece. They are among all American Indians. Why these symbols? We have two reasonable possibilities and explanations. One, the migration of the symbol itself. Namely, that in some remote period, certain basic cultures that have now perished were much more broadly disseminated around the earth than we realize. And as we follow certain migrations, such as the bow and arrow migration or the swastika migration, we find these symbols traveling with the motions of people through the primitive world, passing from one culture group to another. The second possible explanation lies in the internal development of man himself, by which, consciously or unconsciously, he creates symbols which have an essential identity, which have an essential consistency. And when he thinks about certain things, he always thinks of the same symbols, regardless of where he is or to what culture he may belong. Therefore, symbolism may arise with the unfolding human culture. And the symbols are same or essentially similar may appear at many different places because unfolding human beings reach certain cultural levels. And when they reach these levels, they'll instinctively release these symbols through themselves. Now this has an interesting meaning for us because in our present consideration, alchemy, we find the greatest conglomeration of symbols that were ever probably brought together in the service of a single idea, doctrine, science, or art. Yet these symbols are not essentially original with alchemy. There is perhaps not a single symbol in alchemy that can be traced directly to the period in which it began to flourish in that usage. These symbolisms are derived from practically every previous culture that man developed. From Egypt, from Greece, Rome, India, China, all of these ancient systems use the same symbol. It makes very little difference whether it is the dragon of alchemy, or the dragon of St. George of Cappadocia, or the dragon of China. These dragons are all the same. The same may be said of the unicorn, or of many other similar devices, the double-headed eagle, for example, which occurs in so many, many places. The symbolism of fire and of water, of earth, and of the elements, does not belong to alchemy, but alchemy made use of it. So we are in a more or less peculiar situation. We are trying to explain why certain symbols became associated with a cult or a sect of persons engaged in a particular art or science. Certainly there is nothing in the subject of chemistry itself which suggests such a phantasmagoria of devices. And modern chemistry, with great efficiency, depends almost entirely upon comparatively elementary mathematical symbols. Yet in this day, it was different. In the 16th and 17th centuries, we have some of the most magnificent manuscripts ever illuminated by the human hand. Not of the quality of the great works of art which preceded them, but of a fantastic imagery which gives them a dynamic, a significance and importance, causes them to be one of the most valuable and prized group of manuscript materials. Why? Let us assume for a moment for what we must assume at this time. That alchemy was, as its name implies, a divine kind of chemistry. Man had hit upon a truth which he had long held with veneration, but had never explored. And that truth was that each art and science is dependent upon a great pattern of universal laws for its validity. These laws are infinitely repetitive in nature. Da Vinci in his aesthetic canon shows how the body is composed of an infinite repetition of certain basic forms. Knowledge is composed of an infinite repetition of basic patterns on various levels. Alchemy devised the belief, or developed the belief, that the laws governing chemistry were identical with the laws governing every other phenomenon in nature. That to understand chemistry to its very source was to understand creation. That creation and chemistry were intimately related. That man is a chemical formula and an alchemical mystery. That the human body is not only composed of chemical elements, but contains within itself a being composed of alchemical elements. What is true of the body on one level is true of the soul on another. And the entire economy of human life is a tremendous formula. A formula that may be traced under certain conditions. A certain turnaround is itself a kind of catalyzing agent. We know that Baron Emanuel Swedenborg was led to his own inner mystical and spiritistic experiences through the study of mathematics. Mathematics opened in him something. And to another group, chemistry opened something. Through concentration upon the rules and principles of chemistry, the chemist gradually became internally apperceptive of something beyond the subject under consideration. He released something through himself. And that which he released came to his objective consciousness in the form of symbols, as is still the case so frequently in the releases of various subjective pressures in dreams. As Jung has pointed out, all alchemical symbols are found in dream symbolism also. And they are found in the dreams of persons who haven't the slightest concept of what alchemy is, and perhaps have never in their lives seen an alchemical symbol. Yet of themselves, their dreams took these very same forms. And we are led, therefore, to the implication that certain forms are archetypal, that they rest in the collective unconscious of our race, that they are part of something, as we may say, that is larger than we are. And we find these symbols occurring in three ways. We find them coming through in dreams. We find them coming through in esoteric arts and sciences, which include journalism. And we find them coming through in folklore, tradition, and legend. Always the same symbols. Legendary is a kind of symbolism. emerging from man himself, who traces his own origin beyond the objective into a subjective. And in this tracing, goes back into a layer of symbolism within his own nature. Now, we have in the Arabian Nights Entertainment a kind of romantic picture which could well look like a leaf from an alchemical manuscript. We have the legends of the age of chivalry, of the Greeks, of the Egyptians, of the Hindus, the Chinese. The appearance of the mysterious, fantastic creatures and beings. We also immediately fall upon one of the most common of all these symbols, and that is the hero. The mysterious being possessed of supernatural power, but not a god. Where would folklore be without the hero? Where would the story of the Aladdin's lamp be without Aladdin and the lamp? Where would the wanderings of Sinbad the Sailor lead to without their mysterious complications? Or Homer's story of the wanderings of Odysseus. Always these hero legends involve transcendental powers. Demons, saints, gods, godlings. And a hero with magic instruments, a shield of strength, a sword that sings, a charm of invisibility. All these things are part of fairy story, legendary, and lore. They are all diffused and diversified throughout the entire structure of human society. Now, we may say, why did the alchemist hit upon this peculiar fantasy of symbolism? There is no doubt that the answer lies in the nature of his own mind and the time to which he lived. Quite removed, for instance, from the immediate speculations of alchemy, was that very studious, very dour old gentleman, Father Athanasius Kirchhoff of the Society of Jesus. He was a typical example of a 17th century scholar. He was within the body of the church, but he was wedded first to knowledge. This strange scholar was one of those who recognized or felt what it meant to break through the strange pattern which was broken by the Renaissance and the Reformation. Kirchhoff immediately searched in every department and every bracket of culture for knowledge. The Museum of Kirchhoff in Rome was for centuries a place where you could see everything from Egyptian gods to stuffed crocodiles. All knowledge was his province, a tremendous hunger. A hunger that reached out to try to find meaning in everything. At the time that alchemy arose, this hunger was strong in European thinking. Noble princes had their cabinets, as they called them, their choice little museums, in which they had gathered the antiquities and relics of ages. Men prized everything that was new or different, or which had previously been inaccessible to them. They speculated on Egyptian glyphs. They tried to restore the medical system of Hippocrates. They collected and assembled Gnostic gems. They had many Indian, Chinese, Japanese idols, not as objects of worship, but as mysteries and curiosities. This opening of the door sent man's mind scurrying in every direction in search of knowledge. And he was overwhelmed by the tremendous inflow of tradition that poured in upon him the moment he was able to receive it. As soon as he could read and write, a vast pageantry of ideas moved in upon him. An alchemical symbolism leveled off almost completely as being based upon the tradition available to 17th century man, if he possessed the faculties and means of attaining it. Scholarship became a fetish. Learning became something that even the most superficial dilettante, devotees like to. There was a tremendous upsurge in the desire to know. And what was available to the man who saw? The ruin of the past. Broken monuments, this desecrated altar. Broken images, strange figures, part human, part animal, found in the ruins of Egypt. Many incredible devices, the real meanings of which he did not know. He could not read the glyphs of Egypt. The Rosetta Stone had not been discovered. But the less he knew about these things, the more tremendous their influence was. Because he then bestowed meaning upon them. And in bestowing this meaning, he was constantly drawing it out of himself. Each of these unknown objects of his contemplation called upon him, demanded something from him, and also gradually revived tradition, myth, and legend in him. So here was a tremendous amount of raw material available to create thinking patterns in human minds. Now another angle we shouldn't overlook is the relationship between internal patterns and external stimuli. Relations which we may term associational. We have today in psychology association word tests. A word is spoken, and the person taking the test is supposed to instantly reply with the word that first comes to his mind. Association. Now let us assume for a moment that the human being, moving from within himself, is impelled by the pressure of ideas. Now, an idea is a pretty difficult thing to get a good look at. It doesn't have many boundaries. It doesn't have much of a shape. It is more elusive than an amoeba when it comes to trying to find a definition for it. It's a sort of a mysterious, shapeless something that has existence without appreciable or measurable boundaries. There would be nothing less useful to man than a free idea in space. He wouldn't know what to do with it. He wouldn't know if he had it. He wouldn't know if he lost it. Because all that is there is something that is alive and yet has no body. And because it has no body, intellectual, emotional, or physical, it is utterly intangible and yet it exists. Now, man will never permit an idea to remain in that state. It's instinctively impossible for him to do so. Somewhere in the process of the emergence of thought impulse from within his own nature, he meets the outcoming or outpouring thought with a series of vessels suitable to contain it in some way. He must invest it with body. He must give this idea a form so that he can get hold of it. Perhaps he gives it a word form. Perhaps he doesn't. Much of this symbolism could be almost immediately cleared up. If we saw a man struggling from the hieroglyphic to the hieratic period in writing, man could draw pictures of things, but he could not draw pictures of ideas. He could draw a beautiful picture of a house, but how was he going to draw a picture of love? You had to hit upon that happy thought of a heart with an arrow. Draw a picture of veneration. Well, the only thing he could think of was to make a figure in a position of veneration. If he wanted to show imagination, he had to use something that was suggestive, an image, or a mirror, or some device appropriate. And yet even that, in that case, he wasn't sure how he was going to carry on the transmission of this idea. The Mayas, for example, we just mentioned, had quite a problem with verbs, and verbs are always difficult in a hieroglyphical language because they represent action. Pictures do not move. Pictures do not possess action. It must be intimated in some way, a little series of footprints going along, to try to show that a man is taking a walk. The Maya is upon the simple device of taking a noun or a glyph representing an object and transforming it into a bird by adding a wing.
They put a wing, like the wing of a bird, on the side of it, to indicate action, to indicate life. But it was no longer an object, but a process, or a condition in action, which they sought to represent. So the development of languages shows us how these things happen. But how rapidly they happen in the development of an idea within man. Idea itself is presented to him as well as to others. In its pure form, it is a ray of energy. He must clone it. Now, he cannot clone it with something that he knows nothing of. To clone an idea in an unknown form is inconceivable, because man cannot conceive of an unknown form. Any form that he can conceive of must exist. Furthermore, he is confronted with another immediate problem. Forms are of two kinds. Forms suitable for the expression of facts on a level of existence as we know it. Houses and trees and dogs and cats. These do not offer any great amount of problem. But man frequently wishes to represent in his idea something essentially transcendent. Something which is not of this world worldly. He has to break the familiar pattern in order to present an unfamiliar idea. How does he do it? He takes familiar things and puts them into an unfamiliar arrangement. The only method that he has. He recognizes not only that in so doing, he saves his idea from being misinterpreted, and also he creates an impact by it, which is missing in familiar things. Therefore, we can say that an ego he can use. An ego can represent a number of things. But everyone who sees it says this is an ego, and he needs a real ego. So what does the man do with an idea? He makes a two-headed ego. In so doing, he has immediately broken away from reality. Your impressionistic artist is trying to do it constantly. The man who sees the two-headed eagle immediately says to himself, there is no such a bird. Therefore, this does not mean the bird. It means something else. It has to. So we break through realities of a literal nature and escape into the imagery of ideas. Now, every one of us, growing up, is in contact with the world around us. We are also under the pressure of the world within us. When we begin to think of good as small children, we can't think of good just as something good. Good has no meaning. Good has to be immediately associated with the act of goodness, or some person or thing which we can use to appreciate goodness. So perhaps the small child in a strong and happy family environment experiences good under the symbol of parent. Parent's good to him, takes care of him, protects him. That's good. Another man may interpret good under the form of fine, well-balanced dinner. That's good. Good, however, always has to come to us under symbolism because it's an abstraction. The Good Samaritan is a good deed. Now, a good deed without some symbolism by which you see what a good deed is meaningless. Yet instinctively, the moment we have the term good deed come into our mind, the abstraction takes the form of some good deed that we have known, experienced, or heard about. We immediately clone this thing ourselves in a familiar term, in a familiar word picture, or a familiar form picture. We use distortion exactly as Michelangelo used distortion to create a dynamic. If Michelangelo's figure of Moses stood up, we would see that it was a totally disproportionate figure. Yet because of his arrangement of mass, it gives us a tremendous dynamic, which is the thing that he was trying to do, Western. for by distortion we dramatize. We escape from literality, from smallness, from ordinariness, and transcend into something else. The Greek and Egyptian priest put a mask over his face. The moment he did so, he was no longer a person, he was a god. And he not only caused others to think so, but he thought so. Because of the ritual of the mask and his own belief that this sacred symbol transformed him. So that the action of the departure from the real, from the literal, by the use of fantasy, has been primitive in mankind and has been there since the beginning of time. So in our alchemical symbolism, we find a group of emblems that vanish, arising out of certain great archetypal patterns experienced by the human being. And he, in his own effort to experience things superior to material facts, began to flow instincts, impulses, ideas, inspirations from within himself in certain forms. If he had clothed them in ordinary forms, they would have appeared ordinary. But he did not want them to appear ordinary, because these stories he was telling were not ordinary. And had he placed them in mathematical ciphers, which he well knew, he would then have been on the level of chemistry itself, which is not what he wanted to do. He wanted to tell you of chemistry as an experience of consciousness, and not as a series of scientific formulas. He was working for a consciousness dimension. Just as Michelangelo wished to convey the terrific impact of the great Mosaic lawgiver in his Moses. He wasn't trying to be a master of anatomy, although he had to be a master of anatomy to do what he did. He wanted to create something that was unworldly and had a dynamic strength beyond that of man. Therefore, he fashioned it in a way that instinctively related into the experience of the person seeing it this unreality, that is, the lack or absence of complete physical integration, something beyond physical things. Now, in his day, he did not have a great deal to work with. The alchemists, like Michelangelo, had the human body. Like certain of the great religious mystics, he had the scriptures. He used them. Like certain great artists, he had the entire art pageantry of a dozen nations. He made use of all of them. But primarily, his purpose was to tell us from the beginning that he was transforming formulas into living patterns, clothing them in symbolism, which broke reality, broke objective reality in the sense of the everyday, the mediocre, the commonplace, the familiar. Familiar symbols for familiar ideas. But for an idea that cannot become familiar, which is strange to us, an unfamiliar symbol, or one that breaks the common patterns of things. The Egyptians were masters of it, and a large part of alchemical symbolism is based upon the hieroglyphics of Apollos Neos, one of the last of the old Egyptian hieroglyphic compilers. Records of these old myths and symbols. Your emblem writers of the Middle Ages, your emblemists, did the same thing. Your emblemists took morality and changed it into symbols, just as your alchemists took science and did it. So the psychology of this thing is this release of the unfamiliar, which must clone itself in a form which breaks conservative, recognized patterns, because these patterns would drown the idea. And from this reason, they call upon the great magical symbolism of antiquity, which in itself gave a tremendous sense of unreality. the Minotaur of Crete, the human being with the head of a bull. There is an impact there. We know it cannot mean a physical, factual thing. It breaks the familiar. So does the dragon of Andromeda. It breaks the past. We are away from worldliness. We are in a different kind of universe, a universe of fantasy, a universe of fairy tale and folklore, an inner universe, a universe of subjective things, where the consciousness forms and fashions ideas in the same way we release them through dreams. Though dreams must not be factual completely. They must have an element of fantasy, because they represent internals rather than externals, and we can only symbolize them through Alchemy, then, is trying to tell us of the experience of chemistry, of what chemistry means to an individual who receives a total impression of it as an experience of consciousness. He experiences it as a dynamic, not as merely a science or an art. He experiences it as a transformation or a transmutation of his own existence. Here is your mystical dimension coming in, which is probably the most important dimension in the alchemical symbolism. Now, this is a sort of an elaborate preamble, but it is more or less necessary to set our pattern. Now, let's see what some of these symbols were. Some are familiar, some unfamiliar. But even the familiar ones mingle into an unfamiliar pattern. And unfamiliar ones become so well known to us that they seem like old friends before we get through. This symbolism derives itself from a basic authority. The authority of instinct, the authority of childhood, the authority of the primitive and direct impulses of man's own patterning procedure. So we might not be surprised to find in alchemy two symbols almost immediately appearing. One is the king and the other the queen. Now the king, of course, is an experience that every human being has had. The king is the boss on any level, in any way you want to look at it. The king is leadership, rulership. The king is law. The king is order. The king is power. And there isn't the most mild and apparently unambitious member of the proletariat who does not secretly in himself know that he is the king. Every man is a little king. He's modest about it sometimes, by choice, more often by necessity, but he's still the king is also, of course, God. Because God represents the supreme ruler. We'll never forget that little book of Clarence Day, God and Father. Much in common. But the king is also, in a mysterious way, our instinctive recognition of a power that reposes within the universe, within ourselves. The king is life. Rules everything. The king is power, life, through life. The king is the universe in which we live. We are his subjects. The king is spirit, the master of the great court of the universe. The king is nearly always beyond and above and superior. The king is heaven in China. Therefore, the king represents a great positive polarity. The king is not only something we fear, something we must obey, whether we will or not. It is something, furthermore, that secretly we admire. When we are happy, we wish the king would leave us alone, but when we get in trouble, we rush to him for help. We do not like to have him boss us, but we are constantly hoping he will save us. The king is will, for sovereignty, of an active agent in the universe. Now, the opposite polarity to this is the queen. And the queen has always been associated with the broad concept of creation itself, Father God and Mother Nature. The queen represents, to a very large measure, the entire environmental life of the individual. The king is self. The queen is everything else. The queen is the universe, which man, self, desires to possess. Therefore, every move we make reminds us of Goethe's immortal lines, "The eternal feminine lures us on." The eternal feminine is the unknown. And to conquer and capture and to possess the unknown is the great ambition of man. And science fiction, as we have it today, with all kinds of fantastic stories about other dimensions and rays and energies and weird creatures from other worlds, they're all the story of the king searching for the queen, seeking to possess the unknown. Most peoples have referred to their own lands, their continents, their homes as their mother. The Mother Earth, Mother India, Mother China, the Motherland. Occasionally, some nations refer to it as the Fatherland. And here again, we come into some intricate symbolism. And most countries that have a fatherland have a psychology that is quite different from those that have a motherland. We mustn't forget that these things work together in a very important symbolism. So in the great alchemical empire, we have the king and queen ruling over the entire picture. Now the king comes back to us again from one of the most mysterious and enigmatical pursuits of mankind, and that is the game of chess. Because in the game of chess, we are not only playing the game of war, but we are playing the game of life. Now, in the game of life, the queen can be taken, but not the king. In other words, the king is never captured in a game of chess. He is placed in a condition or a position in which he cannot move without jeopardy, and that constitutes checkmate and is the end of the game. Can't take him. You destroy him by preventing him from moving. You cannot take him away. Now, as you think a little bit, you begin to see how that plays into another idea. Very intriguing. You cannot capture spirit, but you destroy its power when you prevent its motion. You cannot destroy truth, but you prevent its power when you no longer permit it to have circulation, or to be disseminated, or to be spread or interpreted. You destroy things by destroying their action, but you cannot destroy the reality of anything, which is always the game. So we have, as in China, Father Heaven and Mother Earth. And you have man created between these by the action one upon the other, forming the great Chinese triad, heaven, earth, and man. Now, what is man? In the alchemical tradition, man is mercury. Now, you may not all recognize yourself as this delightful little character with wounds on his heels and on his head. But, and carrying, of course, the celebrated Caduceus, usually dressed in the garb of a Roman soldier. Very important part of symbolism. But Mercury is the beloved son of the king and queen. Now, when you make the king and queen in alchemical symbolism, you have several ways of doing it. One way is to show the king as a human body with a crown, but instead of the face of the sun. And the queen, a woman with a royal crown, but instead of her face, the face of the moon. So that the king and queen become the sun and moon. And the sun and moon in alchemy are gold and silver. But not the gold and silver that we see, says Basilus Valentine of Algeta, but an invisible gold and silver. The two precious rulers of the metals, the king and queen of the world of the metals. Therefore, we have another mysterious point, namely that Mercury is the sun of gold and silver. He is the child, not only as the deity, but as the element. Now, what is Mercury? Mercury is quicksilver, and was so called. Mercury is Hermes, from the root of Herm, fire. Mercury is the most volatile and the most catalytic of the elements in the alchemical symbolism. Mercury is the only element that can accept into itself all elements and reconcile them. So man becomes the power, the only element, or the only matter, which can bring about within himself the fusing of the metals, or to act as the common denominator of metals. And yet it is not Mercury as we see it, but a volatile spirit of Mercury that must be used in this mystery. So we have a mysterious combination of king, queen, and sun. That is S-O-N, composed of sun, S-U-N, moon, and Mercury. Now another way of calling the sun, moon, and Mercury is to say salt, say sulfur, salt, and gypsum. And these are a formula. For all of the great achievements, the great stone of the wise is composed of salt, sulfur, and mercury, also the universal medicine. Now we have learned that the king is something that can never be taken. The king is the absolute ruler, but things can happen to him. He can appear to die. He can be destroyed or attacked by his own son, but he cannot actually be killed. We'll find out a little more about what can happen to him in the alchemical game of chess a little later. At this moment, we also have another symbol that presents itself to us, and that is what is called the Hermetic Androgyne. This is the royal figure of the king and queen as one person with two faces, one male and one female, and a single crown over the double head. Here we have heaven and earth as one. When so represented, the symbol of Mercury is usually in the middle of the body of this combined androgenic creature. So we now have gold and silver undivided. We have God and nature undivided. We have the sun and moon united in the hermetic marriage of the planets. We now have the God Ishvara concept of India, the father, mother, God, undivided. This actually represents the supreme representation of the king and queen, inasmuch as it represents the mystery of the great energy itself upon which all alchemical mutation depends. This mystery is called Azoth. And Azoth is the tremendous power residing in metals by which the transmutation can take place, or by which they can be changed, or by which their lives may be augmented. Seeing the king and queen now, then, as one being, heaven and earth, representing this as the solitary and inevitable unity of God itself, we have almost a symbol of the tetractys, or the basic triad of life, the king, the queen, and the child, the 47th proposition of Euclid, with a slightly different presentation. The next thing we have to realize is that the king, by what we know,
represents spirit. And the queen represents matter. And Mercury represents soul. Spirit, body, soul. When spirit, body, and soul are brought together into a compound, that compound is called form. Matter is essentially shapeless. Spirit is essentially. But when Mercury imposes the archetype upon them, they become a form. Therefore, Mercury was called Hermes Trismegistus, the thrice greatest, the master of the three. And this mysterious power of Hermes is man. Man is manus. Manus is mind. Mind is more, however, than the intellect that we know it, as we know it. So we will take a picture from one of the alchemical writings, and we will see Mercury carrying in one hand the sun, and in the other hand the moon. He is the juggler of the sun and moon, and he is so represented on a deck of tarot cards. He is the juggler. And Mercury, in this position, bears upon him, or associated with him, the five symbols of the planets, with himself in the middle. That is, the five planets other than the sun and moon known to the ancients. Sometimes Mercury is represented seated in a cave with six other figures around him with planets, symbols for heads. Mercury, as we go further into the symbolism, obviously represents one thing in man, and that is what we call the soul. The soul, which is the juggler of the sun and moon, and which is the ground of reconciliation between spirit and matter, which is the power to arbitrate the conflict of consciousness and form, or body. Consciousness in body would die. Body in consciousness could not exist. But soul is the bridge. Soul is the mortar, or the catalyst. The agent which is the moderator between extremes. All conscious energy moving into form moves through soul and is transformed. All bodily energy moving inward toward consciousness passes through soul and is again transformed. Soul is the modifier, the agent, by which all things are adapted to either their internal or external objectives. So we come again, on a psychological level, to the problem of the introvert and the extrovert. The extrovert represents consciousness moving through soul into body and into its manifestation outwardly. The introvert is energy moving inward from the objective parts of the consciousness through the soul to the subjective parts. But the soul has to occupy the middle distance because it represents the interpreter of all things. It represents the power which transforms all energies into useful, understandable, or acceptable forms. Therefore, the soul becomes a magician who carries a wand, the wand that is sometimes twisted with the serpent, the symbol of the Manus. The soul is therefore also the messenger of the gods, the Greek concept of Hermes, or the Roman Mercury. The messenger is the one who carries the will of the gods to the world. And therefore, in the alchemical symbolism, it was useful, necessary, or proper to represent him by the caduceus, which represented the cerebrospinal and autonomic nervous systems, which are the carriers or messengers of nerve energy. So consciousness controlling its body has Mercury, its sun, to represent it. The body, man's outer life, learning, studying, gaining wisdom and knowledge, seeking to enrich internals, must send this externally accumulated material into consciousness through the messenger, Mercury. And the messenger in this case is identical with the little squirrel that used to fly up and down or run up and down the ecclesial tree in the Odinic mysteries, carrying the scandals of men to the gods and the scandals of the gods to men. It is the messenger power, the communicator. Now, why is it that the alchemist felt that this mercury was able to accept and interpret all metals, or must devour or eat up metals before it was possible to release the soul of the metal? The answer to the situation was very definite. The alchemist insisted that the metals, which represent on one level of thinking phenomena, or the forms of things as they appear to be, based on unpurified, can never be accepted into consciousness. They can never be used to build consciousness. Because before any of these objective things can be useful or necessary and vital to an internal subjective, they must be transformed. The base forms of these metals must die by being absorbed into mercury. And after they have been absorbed and have been reduced to a completely impersonal state, only then does the soul use them to augment its own power. So in one alchemical symbolism, we find Hermes or Mercury devouring the metals, eating them, just as John in Revelation ate the little book of knowledge. So the soul, devouring the metals, experience, transforms them into soul power. And the soul power is, of course, the regenerated, reborn metals. Thus we can say what happens to us in life, what we call experience, is not important. It is our acceptance and understanding of that experience that is important. And though that experience passes through a transformation within our own soul life, it contributes nothing to our improvement. There are people that have things happen to them every day and never learn anything. It isn't what happens. It's the power of the soul to transform all external things that makes possible the adaptation of knowledge through internal enlightenment.